The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com. FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we have the author of The Soul of Christmas. He's also the author of Care of the Soul, Thomas Moore. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be with you today.
The Soul of Christmas, this is an inspirational book, but also I would say The Soul of Christmas, perhaps a self-help book?
I suppose a self-help in some way. You know, I don't like that category too much for myself, but it's like family self-help, maybe. I think it's for families, largely, people who like to celebrate Christmas and would like to do it more meaningfully or have certain problems with Christmas. I guess in that regard, there's a little bit of self-help in it. But I think also it's just a deepening of the idea of Christmas for anybody. That's the tagline I use for this is Christmas for everyone.
Thomas, you know, there are a lot of religions. Christmas, of course, the name of Christ in the name. Politically correct. I mean, now we say happy holiday. You know, we don't say happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas anymore. Is this book actually for everybody, and are we sometimes a little bit too politically correct?
I think we are too correct, definitely. I would like to be at a place where we could use word Christmas, and we could talk about Hanukkah, or we would discuss celebrations that are Buddhist or anything, and enjoy that multiplicity without having to streamline it all down to politically correct and kind of meaningless language. Because, I mean, Christmas is Christmas, and it has that tradition. I think a lot of people today might go and learn Buddhist meditation. Now, you have no problem with it. You don't have to become a Buddhist to do that. People go over to visit Thich Nhat Hanh in France because they want their spiritual life enhanced. But we don't do that with Christianity, and I wish we could. So that's my idea of this Soul of Christmas here, is that anybody could come to it, but I don't want to water it down so that the story of Christmas isn't there.
You have kind of pretty much stories in this book that anybody, any religion, could actually relate to, don't you?
Oh, yes. I try to bring that out throughout, that there are many images in the story of Christmas. For example, the image of the star. In the story of Christmas, it's in the gospel story, these magi, these astrologers from the east, somewhere in the east, come to visit this child who's born, and they bring gifts, and they follow a star to get there. Well, we know that these magicians at that time, the name was for people who used astrology primarily in their magic. And today we don't understand what magic's all about. We have a very superficial idea about it. But in those times, magic was really very serious and quite important, as was astrology. So that's an example. You have the Christmas story with a kind of pagan astrology in it. And that can speak to people who are interested in that approach to spirituality today.
You were talking about in the Soul of Christmas, about when Jesus was in the manger and to actually place yourself there. And not necessarily in the Bible did they talk about the baby Jesus being surrounded by animals, but you suggested maybe like the sheep with the stick legs, the bull is Taurus. It's almost like an astrological chart.
Yes. I think that's pushing a little bit, but I think it's in the spirit of the times when these things were written, when these stories developed. If you have a cow or a bull in the scene, someone's going to immediately think, oh, that's Taurus. That's the astrological sign of Taurus. And if you see a star, they're going to say, oh, that is astrology because that's what that is. If you see, the night sky, if you have the sense of night about this whole thing, then you're going to be thinking, well, this is meditating on the night sky. That has been, I don't think a lot of people understand this, but centuries ago, that idea of looking at the sky for its poetry, for images that speak to us and can be used to help us reflect on ourselves, that was going on very seriously for centuries and centuries, and only ended about 500 years ago when we became more sophisticated about science.
You talk about, in your book, The Soul of Christmas, about whether it's the Buddha, Muhammad, Jesus, that they all came in pretty much poor and destitute, didn't they?
Yes, there's this idea, it's been written about by many people, that that whenever some great figure is born, there are certain themes around the story, and one of them is to be abandoned. Like Moses is abandoned, put into a little basket, put in the river. That story is replicated hundreds of times. I mean, time after time after time. And so we have that pattern in the story of Jesus, in a sense. I mean, in its own way, each story has its own form in which that idea of abandonment appears. In the case of Jesus here, there's no room in the inn. I think that line is so important, and it has been used throughout history. People have picked up on it. Because you know that says something about yourself. How many times have you been in a situation where the door has been closed in your face? I could tell story after story of that in my own life. And I think that that idea of not being accepted is part of this, even for ourselves, part of what Joseph Campbell used to call our own hero's journey. So we have to embark on our own life and face challenges. And there are times when we will feel abandoned and don't have a home, don't have a place to be.
You talk about a story like that in your book, The Soul of Christmas. Now, I know that there are people that say, you know what, I will probably fail, so why even try? You yourself, with a letter, perhaps, that they were wanting you someplace, and they said, oh, nope, that was a mistake. I mean, you know, how do people move on from there? And that's why I think The Soul of Christmas sometimes could be actually a self-help book, even though you don't like them.
Yeah. Well, I'll accept it if people don't want to read it. It's fine. Well, yes, I think there is that side to this whole story. The thing is that the story is about this child, this infant, who, even though he's rejected, of course, we know that he transforms human history, if nothing else. I mean, there's such a fantastic result from this humble birth. And I think that's something that we can identify with, even though we run into these obstacles, and even though we don't have everything that we wish we had as our background, and we wish we knew more or had more experiences, that we can still achieve and we can thrive in spite of it all. I think that's this image of the child in the manger. Seems to me, for ourselves, it's saying that there's something in us that's always infant, always being born, always. So we have to nurture that and take care of that rather fragile part of ourselves that's like a new being that's appearing. And I think that's what we celebrate at Christmas at a personal level.
The soul of Christmas, what is a soul?
Soul is a word, too, that's been around for thousands of years. I mean, it goes back at least 3,000 years. And it's a mysterious word. A lot of people today don't like to use it because it doesn't sound technical, and you can't define it easily, and you can't measure it. You can't study it in a laboratory. But that doesn't mean it's not real. There are so many things that are real that are not in a laboratory. And, like, for example, love is real, but you can't really define it too well or put limits around it. So soul is a word like that. So what it means primarily, I think we use it to mean, to describe ourselves, first of all, that we have more depth, that we're a mystery, that we can't really say who we are. We never come to the end of finding out possibility of what we might be. And that source, the source of all that life, is what we would call the soul. So when I talk about the soul of Christmas, what I'm talking about is a mystery, the mystery of what's going on here that can never be fully explained. And yet it's real, and it's important, And it has a lot to do with our humanity. This is what the old teachings always said, that the soul gives us our humanity and our individuality. So that's what I want to do here with the Soul of Christmas, to say, let's look at this mystery. I don't want to translate it into psychology. I want to go past that. And I don't want to be literal about it, but I also want to make it very real.
Thomas, you are a psychologist.
I do therapy. I have been practicing as a psychotherapist for 30 years, yeah.
You went to school. You studied theology?
I did, yeah.
So when you, you know, the more you get into religion, how does that really cement your faith, or does it so much? Does it kind of tear it apart? Is that a possibility?
I suppose it could be a possibility, but what's torn apart in studying many religions and studying religion itself, which I have done for all my life, when you do that, some of your early ideas of what religion is change, because like any field, you know, you get more sophisticated. You could discuss this. You could talk about any field at all. My dad was a plumber. The more you know about plumbing, the more sophisticated the whole thing gets. You know, you can't go back to your naive idea of what it's all about. And it's the same with religion. You lose religion. I think I am more religious today than I ever have been in my entire life. I have no doubt about that. But I don't fit a category that most people would be happy with or comfortable with, because I've done all this work. And it's, like I say, with any field at all, you do a lot of study and you do a lot of exploration and you think things through, which I've done in all my books, then you're going to be in a different place. To me, it's a deepening of my religious experience, but some people from the outside might look at it and say, oh, he lost his religion. Well, I don't think that's true.
Have you ever thought about that, whether it was school, maybe going to a church, learning the word, maybe going to college? Was there that time that it was like, well, maybe none of this is just real and I'm wasting my time?
Yes, I went through a phase like that. I'd say I went through that when I was about 26 and 27, somewhere around there. And I had a break of a few years, just 3 or 4 years, when I really didn't want anything to do with religion at all. Not at all. I was finished with it. And I had spent a lot of time. I lived in a monastery, studied theology, as you said, but I gave it up. But then someone told me I could get a PhD in religion at Syracuse University in a way that I'd be comfortable. And I said, it's not possible. And they said, well, give it a try. And I did. And I found the study of religion so, so wonderful, so interesting. I've never regretted going into that field. And then I began writing books and teaching. And so all that solidified. And I made a turn then, but as I was saying before, my way of being religious and my way of thinking of religion today is so different from when I started out. It's very different, but I think it's been made more intense and more solid.
I know in your book, The Soul of Christmas, you talk about Jesus not really wanting to create a religion so much. But when I look at other religions, they all have that same feel almost.
Yes.
Am I correct on that?
I think you're right. In most cases, the creators of a new religion or church or community, most of the time, I think what they're doing is trying to create a way of life that is more meaningful for people, where you can be in community together, where we're not just out for ourselves, and where there's a lot of conflict leading to violence. Most religious leaders have been trying to see if there's a way to turn humanity in a different direction, maybe help us evolve spiritually or intellectually at another level. I think that's the main thing Jesus was doing. If you look at the gospel stories, and just if you can do it at all, just let that idea of religion slide off your mind and just see what he's doing. I think what you do is see that he wants to move the human experiment, the human race, up a notch, up a big notch, where we can live differently and not be having all these problems of warfare and domestic violence and all that kind of thing. He wants us to be beyond that, and primarily to become healers rather than conflict makers. And I think, that's fantastic. If we did that, what more would we need? So that's how I look at Christmas. I see it as a time of hope. This is the hope, and the story of Jesus and his idea is hopeful. And we can adopt that story. You don't have to become a Christian. Most of my work these days, especially, I try to present the depth of what Jesus was teaching, and others too, the Buddha and Taoism, all these other religions, the depth of it, and without the church history, without all that history that I think, and I think a lot of that history comes from a faulty understanding of what it's all about.
Thomas, you know, sometimes I ask authors, does your book mirror life or does life mirror your book? Especially if it's maybe a book with a lot of killing or something like that. Is life actually mirroring the Bible, especially like in Revelation? Are there people out there trying to make that prophecy come true?
That's really a subtle question. It's not easy. I would say that there are people certainly who are persuaded that what they understand to be the teachings of the Bible, or let me say especially of the New Testament, that they really believe in it, that if you follow this teaching, that you will be saved somehow, that you will be saved from what? I've often wondered what people mean when they say saved. Well, saved from what? I think they probably mean saved from meaninglessness and from depression and life not working out. That you want to be saved from that situation, that possible. You want your children not to fall into that. You want your children to have a meaningful life and where they can be themselves and be the best they can be. And I think that's a big motivation for people. So I do think that they see these stories and these teachings as a way to find that elusive thing they're looking for. And I don't know if you can find that kind of motivation anywhere but in religion. So if we get rid of religion, I don't know where we're going to be. We need it. But we have had a rather childlike way of looking at these texts. We take them all so literally. We don't see their depth. And that's one of my jobs in life, is to try to bring out the depth of these traditional stories and texts.
So the person maybe that is going through conflict, going through depression, if they might turn to the Bible, they might have something more to believe in?
I think they might have. I don't think belief is really the best way. I don't think belief is a good way of looking at it. I'd rather say that they will have something to guide them. And you have to be careful, because if you take the Bible literally, if you take the Old Testament literally, wow, you'd be caught, you know, you'd be doing a lot of weird things. So you can't do that. You've got to understand that these texts are spiritual poetry. That's what they are. They are using images and stories to convey ideas that are, you can't express plainly. You have to use images of some kind. Jesus himself says at one point in the Gospels, he says, I speak in parables. I love that line, because if we only understood that he uses stories, and if we would approach these things as stories and not take them as facts, we'd be way, way ahead of the game.
All right, Thomas, you have how many books under your belt?
But I think this is 25.
25 books. Well, your last book, I believe, was Care of the Soul?
That was one of the first ones.
That was one of the first books.
That was 25 years ago, yeah.
Goodness sake, so what can you tell me about Care of the Soul? I see it here on the cover of the book, The Soul at Christmas.
Yeah. Well, that's referred to because that's kind of the book that I'm associated with, Care of the Soul. It's kind of the basic book. And that, as I say, I wrote that 25 years ago. And the idea there was to just lay out the basic idea of soul and what that means. And what do you do with soul? You care for it. You care for your soul. You don't educate it. You don't have to heal it. You care for it. It's a constant, ongoing, everyday care. And what does that mean? It means doing everything in your life in a way that has meaning, that your heart is engaged, your emotional life is part of it, and that you become somebody. And soul is also about being connected so that you can relate. So I do a lot of talk about talks on relationship and marriage and that kind of thing, because that's, the soul is right there. It's like when you marry somebody, you know this is way beyond psychology. And you know that the person you've married is far more mysterious than you'll ever figure out. They have a soul. That's the thing. So marriage is largely about souls coming together. I mean, I didn't invent that idea. It's been around for centuries. So care of the soul then is really about how to live your ordinary daily life in a way that your soul is alive and it's not wounded, not hurt, and actually gives you the feeling that life is worthwhile.
So, you know, I hear this a lot. She was my soulmate. He was my soulmate. Is there such a thing?
Well, yes, I think there is. I think if you get a group of people together, I'd say married people, you have to, any kind of deep and important relationship, and ask them how they met. And you will hear, I mean, I've done this, you will hear all these stories of coincidence. You know, oh, I just flew into the airport and here's this person sitting on the bench and I started talking to her and a year later we're married with kids, you know. I mean, it's magic. There is some magic to it. And I think that's one of the qualities of the soulmate, that there's a sense that this relationship is not just a rational one, it's not just to be explained randomly, but there is something special and magical about our coming together. But then I expand that when I write about, I wrote a book called Soulmates right after Care of the Soul. And what I do there is just talk about all relationships having soul and then describe what that's like. So in a way, every relationship is a soulmate.
When a person comes to this earth, they have a soul.
Yes.
And of course, you are pretty much in charge of your soul at what age, I guess? I mean, we do different things when we're children that we probably wouldn't do when we're adults.
Yes. Well, it's hard to say, the way I see it. And by the way, I follow a very ancient tradition here. That's where I get, that's where my foundation is for all this work. It's just looking at how this has been taught over the centuries. And the tradition is that we are born with everything. That means that we're not an empty slate when we're born, but we are born with our full potential of who we are and identity. And that unfolds over time. So, you might be able to see that when you're an adult, and you're doing certain work, you can look back and see that there are roots of that in childhood. And that'd be like an indication that there's something there in your identity that was there when you started out. Now, it unfolds gradually. So you could say that, I would say an infant has a soul, full soul, but the infant can't do much, you know. A little bit, but not a whole lot. But you may perceive, even with the infant, you may perceive individuality there. And that's a sign of soul. Something like, let's say one child is different from another child in the same family. So that soul difference is there. Now, as you get older, hopefully that unfolds, and if you have great opportunities, you can really become somebody as a result over time. Right now, I'm writing a book on aging. It's just about finished. And I'm talking about the other end of life, how there's so much mystery at the other end, too, because you look back on your life and you see what has happened. And there's still more time, and you're still unfolding. And it's an interesting period. That's where I am. I'm 76 now, and I'm thinking about this. And, wow, this is a different point of view than I'm used to. But I'm still connected to my youth. And that's part of the soul, that youth and age are both can exist together. Physically, maybe they don't do too well together, but from the soul point of view, they can both coexist.
You know, the mysteries of the soul, there are religions that believe that once you're dead, you go to either a good place or a bad place.
Yeah.
There are other religions that say that you come back and you're learning lessons.
Yes.
You know, you have to believe what you're going to believe, I guess. I was thinking, that what if, I mean, there's a lot of time. I mean, there's no such thing as time, that you come back as everybody on the earth and you're learning lessons. Is that even a possibility also?
I think it is in a certain way, because when you really think about it, this is another ancient teaching, that we all participate in the one soul. That's a weird thing to think about, but think about it maybe in a small way first, that when you are with someone you love, let's say someone you are living with, it's not unusual for those people to think that they share a soul, you know, that they're so close to each other and there's so much between them that there's something mysterious going on between us here. There's some connection that we can't explain. And you could say, well, they share one soul, and it could be the same with a family. And you just spread it out further till finally you get to everybody. And even then you can go, of course, many religions go further. They say we share the same soul with our planet and with all beings on the planet, which is very, very interesting to think of it that way. Some of the early texts I've studied say that the earth is an animal. The earth, the whole planet is an animal. It means it's one living organism. And like your dog, you know, it's like that. I mean, the planet is like your dog, and it has a personality of sorts. And so I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that way. And I think if we did think that we live in an ensouled world, that we would have a basis for working together more with each other, forgiving each other more, healing in a more full way. And I think we'd solve a lot of our problems.
Well, the brand new book is The Soul of Christmas by Thomas Moore, author of, gosh, around 25 books or so, Care of the Soul, the very first book. If I wanted more information about, Care of the Soul to maybe clear to the soul of Christmas, do you have a website?
I do. My website is called thomasmooresoul.com.
And when we go to your website, what do we see?
You will see me. You will see all the books that I've written, spelled out, each one of them. And you will see the events, places I'm going to speak, and things of that sort. Some blog. I write other blogs. I write for Huffington Post, and I write for Patheos, which is a spiritual blog site. And I also write for Spirituality and Health magazine. So there are a lot of places to get those ideas. I do a tweet every morning, which is on my Facebook page. So every single morning you can get a thought from me that I try to make substantial and I hope well expressed.
There you go. Give you something to think about the rest of the day. Soul of the Christmas, what a nice book. I mean, you do bring up a lot of great ideas in this book. Put yourself in the place of that little baby Jesus in that cradle, of straw. It could be a trough for animals, the animals around. And you just might be a little more humble after reading The Soul of Christmas. Thomas, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Thomas Moore, author of his new book, The Soul of Christmas.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.